I'm really excited to be on this panel and to hear some new data and see some old friends and colleagues. So what I'm going to do is talk about policy strategies for improving fast food. And I spoke on restaurant-related policies at APHA last year. And so if you were here then, you might remember the Halloween-themed policy presentation. So I can't let my old self outdo my current self. So I'm doing the Ghostbusters edition this year, and you'll see why in a minute. But I do want to thank you all for being here because I know a lot going on outside of this room. You know, there's a lot of other great presentations, and there's Frankenstorm on the East Coast, so I hope everyone's homes are okay. But most importantly, and the biggest distraction, is that it's Free Taco Day at Taco Bell. Because someone stole a base in the World Series, and today between 2 and 6, all of America can get a free taco. So if anybody leaves the room, I know where you're going, and you will be shamed. And despite that, I actually am not affiliated with Taco Bell or any other place, so no disclosures. And I do work with a lot of lawyers, so I have to say that I'm not entering into an attorney-client relationship, and I'm just talking about policy options. So what the previous speakers talked about was, just in summary, that science has proven that this stuff is bad for you and kind of gross. And so the question that I will hopefully help answer is, what do we do about it? And what can people at the local and state level in particular do to address the, you know, the poor nutritional quality of a lot of restaurant meals? So my presentation last year focused on some of the legal issues involved in regulating fast food and in regulating marketing, and I'm not going to go back into that except to just say briefly that these are three big legal issues you need to think about. You need to think about, you know, the local authority, if you're working at a local level, whether or not you actually have the legal authority to enact certain regulations. You need to think about preemption, whether or not the state or federal government would preempt your ability to regulate in that particular policy area. And then I'd want to touch a little bit more on the First Amendment, though, because it is very important when you're starting to think about what you could do about fast food and if you're interested in fast food marketing in particular. So most people are familiar with the First Amendment and the fact that it was designed, you know, to protect your freedom of conscience, your ability to, or right to say nasty things about your elected officials. You know, in these last days up until the election, you might have more nasty things to say than normal. And also just your right to express yourself artistically without having to worry about the government trying to stop you or censor you. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the First Amendment also guarantees the right to advertise, or to use a technical term, the right to make and receive commercial speech. So under federal constitutional law, it's very difficult for local communities to restrict, say, the location of fast food billboards. Massachusetts learned this the hard way several years ago when the Supreme Court struck down a statewide ban on tobacco advertising within 1,000 feet of schools because it infringed too broadly on tobacco companies' right to express information about their product and the right of adult consumers to receive that information. So we just need to be cautious when we're thinking about different fast food regulations, not to, you know, fall into this commercial speech area. And so we need to understand a little bit about how lawyers think about marketing. So they think about marketing a little differently from companies. Companies think about marketing, everything they do is marketing, from, you know, television advertising to their logos on trucks, you know, delivery trucks, to, you know, how they price their products and put them in stores. Lawyers think about it a little differently. They think about marketing activities that fall into the commercial speech bucket, so therefore are protected by the First Amendment, and then everything else that isn't protected by the First Amendment. So in the commercial speech bucket, it's things like television advertising, billboards, print advertisements in a magazine. In the other bucket, it's things like the price of products, the ingredients in products, and so on. And so that's really, when we're thinking about these different types of regulations, this other bucket of what lawyers wouldn't consider protected marketing practices. So I've broken down these ideas into three somewhat imperfect categories. So product type policies, product directed policies, restaurant directed policies, and community level policies. So in the product realm, what we're really thinking about here is regulating or restricting access to specific products that the restaurant sells. And a lot of these ideas are currently being discussed and tried out with respect to sugar-sweetened beverages. And that's in part because we have the strongest science around linking sugar-sweetened beverage consumption to obesity and other chronic diseases. But there's no reason why in a few years we couldn't be thinking about other products and trying some of these strategies to limit consumption of other foods. And plus, it's just from a feasibility standpoint, the sugar-sweetened beverages are easier to define and carve out than some of the other products we might think about. So the big one that is on Californians' minds, at least right now, are taxes. And the cities of Richmond and El Monte, California, will be considering sugar-sweetened beverage taxes on their ballots next week. But the basic idea with any kind of product-focused tax is to try to raise the price of unhealthy products, and then just by laws of supply and demand will decline, and then people will ideally consume less of it. The other potentially double benefit of taxes is that if the money can be earmarked, it can then go towards further nutrition interventions, obesity prevention, and so have an even greater impact than just the purely economic impact. And we know from the tobacco world that's known to be the single most effective way to decrease consumption of tobacco is tobacco taxes, high tobacco taxes. So this is definitely a place where the public health community is looking. A little town in New York that you may have heard of implemented serving size limits, or adopted them and will be implementing them next year on sugar-sweetened beverages. So this is just exactly how it sounds, limiting the size of the quantity that can be sold. And another kind of feature of that policy that I don't think New York picked up but could be a part of it is prohibiting free refills. So that sort of undermines even a serving size limit if you can just go back over and over again to refill your container while you're at the restaurant. An idea that is floating out there but no one has tried is proportional pricing requirements. So this idea tries to restrict the volume discount that you get. And this is when you're looking at this menu and you see, well, I kind of want a medium soda, but if I pay 25 cents more, maybe I get 50% more soda. And we all love a good deal, and so why not? But then it pushes you to consume more than maybe you would intend to otherwise. So a proportional pricing requirement, which you could apply to sugar-sweetened beverages or popcorn or whatever, would require that the food or product be sold at a proportional price no matter the size. So, the same number of cents per ounce for small, medium, and large. And so it gets rid of that discount and that sort of incentive to get bigger, go bigger than what you intended. And then there's meal standards, which Jennifer talked about a little bit. The way that San Francisco and Santa Clara County tackled meal standards was tying them to toy giveaways with kids' meals. But again, there's no reason why you couldn't just establish kids' meal standards without worrying about the toy, or even across the board menu meal standards. At least from a legal perspective, that would likely be okay, but you would want to definitely be thinking about political implications and implementation feasibility. But it's definitely another area to be thinking about and looking, thinking about how we might implement it, and it might take a few years for us to figure that one out. So zooming out a little bit, we can look at the restaurant practices as a whole, so not just focusing on specific products, but the restaurant as a whole business. And one idea that has been popping up around the country is healthy restaurant certification. And this is not a regulation, it's a voluntary approach where a city health department or perhaps a community-based organization establishes nutrition standards for a restaurant to follow. It might be that they have to have a certain number of meals that meet certain standards or limit serving sizes or have healthy kids meals. And then they recruit restaurants to follow those standards, and the restaurants get some incentives for participating in the program. They get free advertising, they might get help with nutritional analysis and meal planning. They might get, if the health department's working with economic development agency, they get access to a low interest loan or some sort of business financial incentive as a reward. But the whole idea here is to partner with the restaurant to help them transition their business model, because it is a risk to take to change how you're doing business and the menu options that you're offering, to help transition from one that is predominantly unhealthy to offering some healthy options. But this whole, the sort of whole restaurant policy world is really lacking and we need some more experimentation and development of some ideas around this this bigger area of policy. The city of Watsonville, California has an interesting permit scenario for restaurants where they have to, a restaurant that's opening or that is renovating and needs a business permit has to meet certain nutrition standards in order to get their business permit. I think the idea is really interesting, and I'd like to see more communities trying out things like that. There might be some opportunities around licensing, so requiring tying some nutrition standards to a restaurant license, or thinking about how in the environmental health realm we have these food establishment grades, and they're associated with the food safety, but what if we tied some nutrition standards to that and inspected restaurants on a regular basis, not only for food safety, but for nutrition. And then zooming out a little further to the community, we can use policy to think more intentionally about where restaurants are located relative to where we live and where our kids are on a regular basis. And the tool that is perfect for that and is frequently used is zoning. So this determines where businesses can locate, how land is used in a community. And it's not an uncommon practice for a city to restrict where fast food restaurants can be in the community or the density or even prohibit all formula restaurants through zoning. But thus far, it hasn't really been done out of concerns for nutrition. It's often done to preserve the historical character of a downtown or because of concerns about traffic safety or loitering. But you could certainly, say, create healthy food zones around schools and prohibit new fast food restaurants from locating within a certain distance of schools or parks or churches or so on. So that's an area of policy that's really kind of ripe for exploration, and particularly, with these conversations around nutrition and the obesity epidemic. So just as a final thought or reflection to kick off discussion here, one of the things that I get to do in my work is look at different areas of food policy. And this year I've been really looking at healthy food retail, so more at small, corner stores, convenience stores, those sorts of things. And in that world, there's been perhaps more work being done over time by the public health community. The tobacco control community has been, at least in California, has been regulating small stores and trying to keep them from selling tobacco to minors. And we have a lot of communities here who have required tobacco retailers to get licenses, and there are business practice standards tied to those licenses. And I recently went to a conference where there are a lot of people working on tobacco retailer regulation, and they kind of see themselves, in fact, in some of their presentations, they portrayed themselves as these superheroes crusading against these bad retailers who are trying to sell tobacco to kids. And then on the nutrition side, you have a lot of communities working with retailers in this more voluntary partnership manner, where they're working with them to stock more healthy products and giving them incentives and free advertising and so on. And so they're approaching food retailers or these small retailers as more of these, you know, these business people who are really struggling, and if they just knew, you know, how to offer healthier products, they would do it, and so we'll help them do that. So this is an area where it seems more developed. There seems to be, at least definitely in California, some work to bring together this regulatory approach and this voluntary approach. And it's a model that I think from the restaurant, on the restaurant side, we could be looking to see what's working. What's working on the regulatory side? What's working on the voluntary side? And most importantly, I think I haven't seen as much sort of concerted dialogue about restaurants in particular, despite the fact that the 50% of household food budgets are being spent at these outlets. So that's just something that I think we should look to that model, and we should really be thinking about, and this is where my Ghostbusters analogy comes in, are restaurants, from our perspective, you know, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, who was this formidable foe that we need to battle and try to protect people from, or is it our friendly partner, and do we need to try the more voluntary approach, or is it some sort of combined strategy that we're looking for? And I say this just to be somewhat provocative, but I'm really curious in comments and questions what people think we should be trying to do. So here's my contact information, and I look forward to the discussion.